Chapter 12. Kevin Westbrook's mother, Webb learned, was probably dead, though no one could tell him for sure. She had disappeared years before. A meth and crack addict, she had most likely ended her life with the prick of a dirty needle or snort of impure powder. The identity of Kevin's father was unknown. Apparently, these were not unusual gaps in personal history in the world where Kevin Westbrook dwelled. Webb drove down to a section of Anacostia even the cops avoided, to a crummy, falling-down duplex amid others just like it, where Kevin reportedly lived with a hodgepodge of second cousins, great aunts, distant kind of sort of uncles or step-brother-in-laws. Webb wasn't really clear on the boy's living situation, and apparently neither was anyone else. It was the new and improved American nuclear family. The area looked like a reactor had been hemorrhaging nearby for a few decades. Apparently, no flowers or trees could grow here. The grass in the small yards was a sickly yellow. Even the dogs and cats in the street looked ready to keel over. Every person, place, and thing looked totally used up. Inside, the duplex was a dump. From outdoors, the stench of rotting garbage was overpowering, and indoors there were offensive odors heightened even more by the close quarters. This lethal combination hit Webb so hard when he walked through the doorway, he thought he might end up kissing the floor. Lord, he'd take tear gas over this homemade toxin any day. The people who sat across from him didn't look unduly worried that Kevin was not among them. Maybe the child routinely disappeared after a shootout of staggering proportions. A sulky young man sat on the couch.
"We already talked to the cops," he said,
more spitting the words at Webb than saying them. "Just following up," said Webb, who didn't want to think about what Bates would do to him if he found out Webb was nosing around on his own. Well, he owed it to Reiner and the other guys. To hell with official bureau policy. Still, the butterflies were numerous and reproducing freely in his belly.
"Shut your mouth, Jerome,"
said the grandma type who sat next to Jerome. She had silver hair, big glasses, an enormous bosom, and a no-bullshit attitude. She had not given Webb her name, and he had not pushed it. It was in the FBI file, no doubt, but he had tracked it down from other sources. She was as large as a small car, and looked like she could take Jerome no problem. Hell, it looked like she could take Webb no problem. She had asked to see Webb's badge and credentials twice before unchaining the door.
"I don't like letting people I don't know into my house," she explained. "Police or otherwise. This area ain't been safe for as long as I can remember, and that's from both sides of the table."
She said this with raised eyebrows and a knowing look that penetrated right to Webb's federal law enforcement soul. "I really don't want to be here," Webb wanted to tell her, "particularly since I'm holding my breath so I won't puke." When Webb sat down, he could see between the wide cracks in the floorboards, all the way down to the hard clay the house was built on. This place must be toasty warm in the winter, he thought. It was about 65 outside right now, and it felt like 30 inside. There was no comforting sound of a furnace going, and no smells of good food simmering in Grandma's nice kitchen. In one corner of the room was a pile of Diet Pepsi cans. Somebody was watching her weight. Yet next to that was a mound of McDonald's trash. Probably Jerome's, thought Webb. He looked like a Big Mac and fries kind of guy.
"I can understand that," said Webb. "Have you lived here long?"
Jerome simply snorted while Granny looked down at her clasped hands.
"She said 3 months. Other place we were in, we'd been there a long time. Had it fixed up nice. But then they decided we made too much money to be living in such a nice place, and they kicked us out," added Jerome angrily. "Just kicked us out." "Nobody said life was fair, Jerome," she told him.
She looked around the filthy place and drew in a heavy breath that seemed to drain all of Webb's hope away.
"We're gonna fix this place up, too. It'll be fine."
She didn't sound too sure, Webb noted. "Have the police made any progress on Kevin's disappearance?"
"Why don't you go ask them?" asked Grandma. "Because they ain't telling us nothing about poor Kevin."
"They lost his ass," said Jerome, as he slid farther down into the mound of sagging, heavily stained cushions that passed for a couch. Webb couldn't even tell if there was a frame left. The ceiling was split open in three different spots that Webb could see, and it sagged down so far you almost didn't need stairs to get to the second floor. You could just reach and pull yourself up. The walls had black mold growing over them, and there was probably lead paint in there as well. And, no doubt, asbestos clung around the pipes. There was rodent excrement everywhere, and Webb would have bet $1,000 that termites had eaten most of the wood in the place, which was probably why it had that little lean to the left he had observed as he had come up the front sidewalk. The building inspectors must have just written off this whole area, or else they were drinking coffee somewhere and laughing their butts off.
"Do you have a picture of Kevin?"
"Course we do. Gave one to the police," said Grandma.
"Got another?"
"Hey, we ain't got to keep giving you stuff," snarled Jerome.
Webb leaned forward and let the grip of his pistol show very prominently.
"Yes, Jerome, you do. And if you don't lose the attitude, I'll just haul your ass downtown and we can go over your record for any outstanding warrants that'll put your little butt away for a while. Unless you want to try and bullshit me and claim you'd never been arrested, Slick."
Jerome looked away and muttered,
"Shit." "Shut up, Jerome," said Grandma. "You just shut your damn mouth."
"There you go, Granny," Webb thought.
She pulled out a little wallet and lifted out a photo. She handed it across to Webb, and when she did, her fingers started to tremble a little, and her voice caught in her throat, but then she straightened everything out.
"That's my last picture of Kevin. Please don't lose it."
"I'll take good care of it. You'll get it back."
Webb glanced down at the photo. It was Kevin, at least the Kevin Webb had saved in the alley. So the kid Cortez and Romano had babysat was somebody else who had lied and said he was Kevin Westbrook. That took some planning, but it also would have to have been on the fly. And yet for what purpose?
"You said you gave the police a photo of Kevin?"
Grandma nodded.
"He's a good boy. He goes to school, you know. Most every day he does. A special school. Because he's a real special little boy," she added proudly.
Down here, Webb knew, going to school was an accomplishment to tout, perhaps second only to surviving the night.
"I'm sure he is a good boy."
He looked over at wild-eyed, felony-in-waiting Jerome.
"You were a good boy too once, weren't you, Jerome?"
"Were they uniformed police?" Jerome stood.
"What, you think that we're stupid? They was FBI, man, just like you."
"Sit down, Jerome," said Webb.
"Sit down, Jerome," said Grandma, and Jerome sat.
Webb thought rapidly. So if the Bureau had a photo of Kevin, then they had to know that they'd had the wrong boy, however briefly, in custody. Or did they? Romano had been clueless about there being two boys. He had just described him as a black kid. What if that was the entire official report? If the fake Kevin Westbrook had disappeared before Bates and the others got on the scene, then all they'd know was a black kid around 10 years old named Kevin Westbrook, who lived at such and such address near the alley, was missing. They'd come here and talk to the family, get a picture, like they had done, and go about their investigation. It's not like they'd for sure go ask Romano and Cortez for a positive ID, especially if they had no reason to suspect a switch. And Ken McCarthy had said the snipers hadn't gotten a look at the real Kevin when Charlie team had passed him on the way in. Perhaps only Webb knew about the deception. Webb looked around, and for the sake of the grandmother, or whatever her relation to Kevin was, he tried hard not to show his disgust.
Did Kevin actually live here?
Bates had said Kevin's home life was miserable and that he probably avoided it when he could, which would explain why he'd been out alone in the middle of the night instead of here in bed. The physical surroundings truly were awful, but probably no worse than many of the other homes down here. Poverty and crime were everywhere, and the marks they left were in no way pretty. Yet Granny seemed solid as a rock, a good person, and it seemed like she genuinely cared for Kevin. Why would he avoid her? Granny and Jerome exchanged a glance.
"Most of the time," said Granny.
"Where would he live other times?"
Neither of them said a word. He watched as Granny looked at her very substantial lap, and Jerome closed his eyes and swayed his head, apparently to some bitchin' music in his head.
"I understand Kevin has a brother. Does Kevin live with him sometimes?"
Jerome's eyes popped open, and Granny stopped looking at her lap. In fact, from the expressions on their faces, it was as though Webb were pointing a gun at them and had just told the pair to kiss their respective butts goodbye.
"Don't know him. Never seen him,"
said Grandma quickly, as she sat there rocking back and forth like something suddenly was hurting her. She didn't look like she could take anybody right now. She looked like an old woman scared out of her wits. When Webb looked over at Jerome, he jumped up and was gone before Webb could even rise. Webb heard the front door open and then slam shut, and then came the sound of feet running away. Webb looked back at Granny.
"Jerome don't know him neither," said Grandma.
Chapter 13. The morning came for the official memorial service, and Webb rose early, showered, shaved, and dressed in his nicest suit. The time to formally honor and mourn all of his friends had come, and all Webb wanted to do was run like hell. Webb had not spoken with Bates about what he'd learned from Romano and Cortez, nor about his visit to Kevin's home. Webb wasn't exactly sure why he hadn't, only that he wasn't feeling in a real trusting mood, and because Bates would no doubt chew him out for interfering in the investigation. To Webb, Bates had identified the kid as Kevin Westbrook, which meant either the boy had told him that was his name, or Bates had gotten it from Romano and Cortez, if the boy had disappeared before Bates had arrived on the scene. Webb would have to confirm which it was. If Bates had seen the other kid, then when he had taken Kevin's photo from the grandmother, he'd have known there were two different kids involved. So Webb had given a kid with a bullet wound on his cheek a note to take to his HRT guys. That kid had told Webb his name was Kevin. The note had been delivered, but apparently not by the same kid Webb had given the note to. That meant that between him giving the kid calling himself Kevin the note and the note being delivered, the boy had been switched with another kid. That could only have taken place in the alley between where Webb was and the charging HRT unit. That wasn't a whole bunch of space, yet it had been enough to pull the switch, which meant other people had been lurking somewhere in that alley, waiting for this to happen, maybe waiting for a lot to happen. Was Kevin's coming down that alley planned? Was he working for his brother, Big F? Was he supposed to check for survivors, and had he not expected to find any? And when he did find Webb alive, had that thrown a monkey wrench in somebody's plan? And what the hell could that plan have been? And why pull one kid out and put another one in? And why did the fake Kevin lie and say Webb was a coward? And who was the suit who had taken the replacement kid? Bates had been pretty tight-lipped about losing the kid. Was the suit Romano had talked to even an FBI agent? If not, how could one imposter have walked right in with creds and bravado impressive enough to fool Romano and Cortez and waltz off with another imposter. It was bewildering, and Webb was so full of doubt that turning to Bates for answers and information sharing was not real high on his list of action items. He parked the Mach 1 as close to the church as he could. There were many cars already there, and the parking spaces relatively few. The church was a somber-faced stone monolith built in the latter part of the 19th century, when the architectural commandment had been, "Thou house of worship shall have more turrets, balustrades, Ionic columns, broken pediments, arches, gables, doors, windows, and cool masonry curlicues than thy neighbor." It was at this holy temple that presidents, Supreme Court justices, members of Congress, ambassadors, and other lesser dignitaries of varying degrees did their praying, singing, and very occasionally confessing. Political leaders were often photographed or filmed going up or down its broad steps, Bible in hand and God-fearing looks on their features. Despite the separation of church and state in America, Webb had always believed that voters liked to see a little piety in their elected officials. No HRT members had attended this church, yet the politicos had to have a grand stage to say their words of consolation. And the little backwoods house of religion near Quantico, where some of the members of Charlie Team had actually done their worshiping, apparently didn't cut it. The sky was clear, the sun warming, and the slight breeze refreshing. It was too fine an afternoon for such a depressing thing as a memorial service, it seemed to Webb. Yet he went up the church steps, each click of his polished shoes on the stone simulating the ding of a wheel gun's cylinder being turned, one chamber, one bullet, one potentially spent life at a time. Such violent analogies were Webb's lot in life, he supposed. Where others saw hope, he only witnessed the raw sores of a festering, degenerating humanity. God, with that attitude, it was no wonder he was never invited to parties. Secret Service agents were everywhere, with their shoulder holsters, poker expressions, and curly ear cords. Webb had to go through a metal detector before entering the church. He showed his gun and his FBI creds, which told the Secret Service the only way Webb and his gun would be parted was if he was dead. As soon as he opened the door, Webb almost bumped into the rear of the mass of people that had somehow squeezed itself into the space. He took the rather uncouth tactic of flashing his FBI shield, and the seas parted, and he was allowed to move through. Over in one corner, a camera crew had set up and was broadcasting the entire spectacle. What idiot had authorized that, Webb wondered. And exactly whose idea was it to invite the whole frigging world to what should have been a private ceremony? This was how the survivors were to remember their dead at a circus? With the help of some fellow agents, Webb managed to wedge himself into one of the pews and then looked around. The families were in the front two rows, which had been roped off. Webb bowed his head in prayer, saying one for each of the men, lingering the longest on Teddy Reiner, who had been a mentor to Webb, a crackerjack agent, a wonderful father, a good man all around. Webb dropped a couple of tears as he realized how much he had really lost in those few seconds of hell. Yet when he looked up front to where the family sat, he knew he had not lost as much as those folks had. The truth was beginning to set in with the younger kids, for Webb could hear their wails at Daddy being gone forever. And the sobbing and screaming continued through all the tired speeches, from the get-tough-on-crime bullcrap from the politicians to the preachers who had never met any of the men they were eulogizing. "They fought the good fight," Webb wanted to stand up and quietly say. "They died protecting all of us. Never forget them, for they were all unforgettable in their own way. End of eulogy. Amen. Let's hit the bars." The memorial service finally was over, and the congregation heaved a collective sigh of relief. On his way out, Webb spoke with Debbie Reiner and offered some words of comfort to Cindy Plummer and Carol Garcia, and exchanged hugs and snatches of more words with some of the others. He squatted down and talked to the little kids, held small trembling bodies in his arms, and Webb just didn't want to let go. This simple physical giving threatened to make Webb start bawling. Tears had never come easily to him, and yet he had shed more of them in the last week or so than he had in his entire life. But the kids were just killing him. Someone tapped him on the shoulder. As he rose and turned, Webb thought he would be comforting one more bereaved person. However, the woman staring back at him did not appear to need or want his sympathy. Julie Patterson was the widow of Lou Patterson. She had four kids and had been expecting a fifth, but had miscarried it 3 hours after learning she had become a widow and single mother. A look at her glassy eyes told Webb that the woman was heavily drugged with what he hoped were doctor-ordered prescriptions. And Webb could smell the liquor. Pills and booze was not a good combo to serve oneself on a day like today. Of all the wives, Julie had been least close to Webb, because Lou Patterson loved Webb like a brother, and Webb had easily sensed that Julie was jealous of that relationship. "You really think you should be here, Webb?" said Julie. She tottered in her black heels, her eyes not entirely able to focus on him. Her words were slurry, her tongue moving on to form others before they had completed the last. She was puffy, her skin pale yet blotched red in spots. She had not carried the baby long enough for her belly to swell, and this lost opportunity seemed to have deepened the woman's hurt. She should be home in bed, and Webb wondered why she wasn't. "Julie, let's go outside and you can get some air. Come on, let me help you."
"Get the hell away from me!"
Julie shouted in a voice loud enough to make those within 20 feet of them stop and stare. The TV crew saw this exchange too, and both the cameraman and reporter apparently simultaneously saw potential gold. The camera swung in Webb's direction, and the reporter headed over. "Julie, let's go outside," Webb said again quietly. He put his hand lightly on her shoulder.
"I'm not going anywhere with you, you bastard!"
She ripped Webb's hand off, and he grunted in pain, cupping his wounded hand near his body. Her fingernails had bitten right into the hole there, ripping out the stitches. It started to bleed.
"What's the matter? Your little hand hurting, you gutless son of a bitch? You with the Frankenstein face. How'd your mother stand looking at you? You freak, you."
Cindy and Debbie tried to talk to her, console her, but Julie pushed them away and got close to Webb again.
"You froze up before the shooting started, only you don't know why. And then you fell down. Expect us to buy that bullshit."
Her liquor breath was so intense, Webb had to close his eyes for a moment, and that only magnified his sense of faltering balance.
"You coward. You let them die. How much did you get? How much did Lou's blood get you, you asshole?"
"Miss Patterson," this came from Percy Bates, who had swept up next to them. "Julie," he said very calmly, "let's get you to your car before the traffic gets really bad. I've got your kids right over here."
Julie's lips trembled at the mention of her children.
"How many are there?"
Bates looked confused.
"How many kids?" Julie asked again.
One hand slid to her empty belly and stayed there, and wet spots from tears marked the front of her black dress. Julie focused once more on Webb, her lips curling back in a snarl.
"I was supposed to have 5 of them. I had 5 kids and a husband. Now I got 4 kids and no Lou. My Lou's gone. And my baby's gone, damn you. Damn you."
Her voice edged upward again. Her hand was making crazy circles on her belly as though she were rubbing a magic lamp, perhaps making a wish for the baby and husband to come back. The camera was eating up all of this. The reporter was scribbling furiously.
"I'm sorry, Julie. I did all I could," said Webb.
Julie stopped rubbing her belly and spit in his face.
"That's for Lou," she spit again. "That's for my baby. Go to hell. You go to hell, Webb London."
She slapped his face, hitting him right on his ruined cheek, and she almost fell over with the effort.
"And that's for me, you bastard. You freak."
Julie's energy was spent, and Bates had to grab the woman before she collapsed to the floor. They got her outside, and the nervous crowd started to drift away into small pockets of discussion. Many of them cast angry, backward glances at Webb. Webb did not move. He had not even wiped away Julie's spit. His face was red from where she had hit him. He had just been proclaimed a freakish monster and a coward and a traitor. Julie Patterson might as well have cut off his head and took that with her, too. Webb would have beaten to death any man who had said those things to him. But coming from a bereaved widow and mother, her insults had to be accepted. He felt like taking his own life instead. None of what she said was true, yet how could Webb deny her any of it?
"Sir, it's Webb, right? Webb London?" said the reporter at his shoulder. "Look, I know this is probably a really awkward time, but the news sometimes can't wait. Would you be willing to talk to us?"
Webb didn't answer.
"Come on," said the reporter. "It'll only take a minute, just a few questions."
"No," said Webb, and started to leave. He wasn't sure until right then that he actually could even walk.
"Look, we're going to talk to the lady, too. And you don't want the public to have only her side of things. I'm giving you a shot to tell your story here. Fair is fair."
Webb turned back and grabbed the man by the arm. "There are no sides. And you let that woman alone. She's had enough for the rest of her life. You let her alone. Stay away from her. You understand me?"
"Just doing my job."
The man carefully edged Webb's hand off his arm. He looked at the cameraman. "Excellent," was the unspoken thought that seemed to travel between the two men. Webb walked out the door and quickly left behind the Church of the Famous and Well-Healed. He climbed in the Mach, fired it up, and headed off. He stripped off his tie, checked his wallet to make sure he had some cash, stopped at a liquor store in the district, and bought 2 bottles of cheap Chianti and a 6-pack of Negra Modelo. He drove home, locked all the doors, and pulled the shades on all the windows. He went into the bathroom, turned on the light, and looked at himself in the mirror. The skin on the right side of his face was slightly tanned, relatively smooth, a few odd whiskers in spots he had missed with his razor. A nice side of skin, not bad at all. Side of skin. That was how he had to analyze it now. The days were long gone when anyone could remark on his handsome face. Julie Patterson had had no trouble commenting on his mug, though. But Frankenstein? That was a new one, Julie. Given time to think about it, he wasn't feeling quite so understanding towards the woman right now. "You would have lost Lou a long time ago if Frankenstein hadn't done what he'd done that cost him half his damn face. Did you forget that? I haven't, Julie. I see it every day." He turned slightly to fully reveal the left side of his face. No whiskers sprouted there, and the skin never really did tan. The doctors had said that this might happen, and there didn't seem to be enough of it. The skin was stretched so tight. Sometimes, when he wanted to laugh or smile really wide, he couldn't because that side of his face just wouldn't cooperate, as though it were telling him to kiss off, buddy. Look what you did to me. And the damage had reached to the edge of his eye such that the socket was pulled more to the temple than normal. Before the operations, it had given him quite an unbalanced appearance. Now the look was better, but the two sides of his face would forever be misaligned.
Under the transplanted skin were lumps of plastic and metal that had replaced destroyed bone. The titanium in his face set off the airport detectors just about every damn time. "Don't worry, guys, it's just the AK-47 I've got stashed up my butt." Webb had endured numerous operations to bring his face back to this point. The docs had done a good job, though he would always be considered disfigured. At last, the surgeons had told him they had reached the end of their professional skills and even their medical miracles, and they'd wished him well. It had been a more difficult adjustment than he had thought, and to this day he couldn't say he was actually through it. It wasn't the sort of thing you ever really got over, he supposed, since it stared back at you in the mirror every day. He cocked his head a little more, inched down his shirt collar, and the old bullet wound on the base of his neck was fully revealed. It had come in above his armor line, and how it missed all vital arteries and his spine was nothing short of miraculous. The wound resembled a cigar burn, a big-ass cigar burn on his skin, he had joked when lying in the hospital bed with one side of his face missing and two large holes in him. And all the guys had laughed with him, though he had sensed the nervousness amid all the chuckling. They were reasonably sure he was going to make it, and so was he. Yet none of them knew what physical and emotional nightmare lay under those bandages. The plastic surgeons had offered to cover up the bullet wounds, but Webb had said no. He had had enough with doctors stealing skin from places on his body and gluing it to others. This was as good as old Webb was going to get. He touched his chest where the other cigar burn was in full blooming glory. It had entered his body and exited at the back of his shoulder, somehow skirting his Kevlar on both ends, and still had enough kick left to erase the head of a guy behind him who was about to cleave Webb's skull with a machete. And who said he wasn't lucky? Webb smiled at himself in the mirror. "Lucky is as lucky does," he said to his reflection. HRT had always held Webb in the highest possible regard for the heroism he had shown that night. It had been the school hostage situation in Richmond, Virginia, executed by the Free Society. Webb had recently switched from sniper to assaulter and was still feeling his way a bit, eager to show his mettle in the front lines. The explosion had occurred from a homemade concoction thrown by one of the Frees. It would have hit Lou Patterson if Webb hadn't leapt and knocked him out of the way. The fireball caught Webb dead on the left side of his face, knocking him down and melting his shield against his skin. He had ripped the shield off along with a good part of his face and kept fighting, the adrenaline that always came with battle the only thing blocking out the horrible pain. The Frees had opened fire, and Webb had taken a bullet through his torso, and the second round had tagged his neck. Many innocent men would have died but for what Webb had done after receiving these injuries. Instead of weakening him, the shots seemed to have energized him, for how he had fought, how he had killed men trying to kill him and his team. He had dragged injured comrades to safety, including the late Lewis Patterson, who had taken a round through the arm a minute after Webb had saved him from the flames. The acts Webb performed that night had far surpassed what he had done in that courtyard, for he had been so badly wounded at the time, no mere hand scratch that time, no simple band-aid that day. To both veteran and new operators at HRT, Webb was a legend. And at the highly competitive Alpha Male Agency, there was no better way to elevate oneself on the pecking order than bravery and skill shown in the heat of battle. And all it had cost him were a few vanity points and most of the blood in his body. Webb didn't even remember the pain. But when the last bullet had been fired and the last man had fallen, he too had slumped to the ground. He had touched the open wound on his face and felt the blood pouring out of him from the two wounds, and Webb knew it was finally his time to die.
He had gone into shock in the ambulance, and by the time the doctors at the Medical College of Virginia got to him, he was almost flatline. How he had come back that night was anyone's guess. Webb certainly didn't have an answer. Never a religious man, he had started to wonder about things like God. The recovery had been the most painful thing Webb had ever done. Though he was a hero, it was no guarantee that Webb would be able to rejoin HRT. If he couldn't carry his full weight, they wouldn't want him, hero or not. It was just the way things were. And Webb would never have wanted the terms to be anything else. How many weights lifted, how many miles run, walls climbed, choppers rappelled from, rounds fired. Fortunately, the wounds to his face had not affected his eyesight or aim. Without perfection there, you were gone from HRT. The psychological battering of his recovery, however, had been even worse than the physical cramming. Could he fire when called up? Would he freeze in a crisis and place his team in jeopardy? Well, no, he never had, at least not until that damn courtyard came along. He had come back, all the way back. It had taken almost a year, but no one could say he didn't deserve to return on his own, with no corners cut. Now what would people say? Would he make it back this time? The trouble wasn't physical this time. It was all in his head, and thus was 100 times more terrifying. Webb made a fist and put it right through the mirror, cracking the drywall behind it. "I didn't let them die, Julie," he said to the shattered glass. He looked at his hand. It wasn't even bleeding. His luck was holding, wasn't it? He opened the smashed medicine cabinet and took out the bottle of mismatched pills. He had collected them over time from a variety of sources, some official, some unofficial. He used them to help him sleep occasionally. He was careful, though, because he'd almost become addicted to the painkillers while they were rebuilding his face. Webb flicked off the light, and Frankenstein was gone. Hell, everybody knew monsters were more comfortable in the dark. He went downstairs and carefully laid out all his bottles of booze and sat in the middle of them, like a general with his aides going over a battle plan. Yet he didn't open a single bottle. The phone rang every few minutes, but Webb never answered it. There were knocks on the door. He let them go. Webb sat there and stared at a wall until it grew quite late. He rummaged through the mismatched pills and took out a capsule, looked at it, and then put it back. He leaned back against a chair and closed his eyes. At 4 a.m., he fell asleep on the floor of the basement. Webb still had not bothered to wash his face. Chapter 14. 7 in the morning. Webb knew this because the mantel clock was chiming when he lifted himself groggily off the basement floor. He rubbed at his back and neck. As he sat up, his foot hit one of the bottles of wine, and it fell over and cracked slightly, and Chianti leaked across the floor. Webb threw the bottle away, grabbed some paper towels, and cleaned up the spill. The wine stained his hands red, and for a dazed moment, his sluggish mind told him he'd been shot in his sleep. The noise outside the rear lower window made him race up the stairs and grab his pistol. Webb went to the front door with the intent of circling around back and getting the drop on whoever was out there. Maybe it was just a stray dog or squirrel, but Webb didn't think so. Human feet, trying their best to keep quiet, just had a certain sound to them if you knew how to listen, and Webb knew how to. When he opened the door, the surge of people toward him almost caused Webb to pull his gun and fire. The reporters were waving microphones and pens and sheets of paper and calling out questions so fast they cumulatively appeared to be speaking Mandarin. They were screaming for him to look this way or that way so they could take his picture, film his video, as though he were some celebrity or, perhaps more apt, an animal in the zoo. Webb looked past them to the street,
where the media ships with their tall electronic masts now were docked outside his modest rancher. The two FBI agents assigned to watch over his house seemed to be attempting to hold back the masses, but were clearly losing the battle.
"What the hell do you people want?" Webb cried out.
One woman wearing a beige linen suit, her blonde hair sculpted, pushed forward and planted her high-heeled feet on the brick stoop, bare inches from Webb. Her heavy perfume made Webb's empty stomach turn queasy. She said,
"Is it true you're claiming that you fell down right before the rest of your squad was killed, but can't explain why? And that's why you survived?"
The hike of her eyebrows signaled exactly what the woman thought of that preposterous story. Another reporter, a man, shoved his microphone near Webb's mouth.
"There have been reports that you didn't actually fire your weapon, that the gunfire stopped on its own somehow, and that you were actually never in any danger. How do you respond to that?"
The questions kept coming as the bodies pressed closer.
"Is it true that when you were at the Washington field office, you were put on probation for a shooting infraction that resulted in the wounding of a suspect?"
Webb said, "What the hell does that..."
Another woman elbowed him from the side.
"I have it on good authority that the boy you allegedly saved was actually an accomplice to this whole thing."
Webb stared at her.
"An accomplice to what? To who?"
The woman gave him a penetrating look.
"I was hoping you could answer that."
Webb slammed the door, raced to the kitchen, grabbed the keys for the Suburban, and headed back out. He pushed through the crowd and looked at his fellow agents for help. They came forward, yanked and pulled on a few people, yet to Webb it seemed their hearts clearly were not in it, and they refused to meet his gaze.
"So that's how it's going to be," Webb thought.
The crowd suddenly surged closer, sealing off the path to his truck.
"Get out of my way," Webb yelled.
He looked around. The entire neighborhood was out watching this. Men, women, and children who were his friends, or at least his acquaintances, were staring at this spectacle with wide eyes, open mouths.
"Are you going to respond to Mrs. Patterson's charges?"
Webb stopped and looked at this questioner. It was the same reporter from the memorial service.
"Are you?" the man said grimly.
"I didn't know Julie Patterson had the authority to bring charges," said Webb.
"She made it abundantly clear that you either acted with cowardice or were somehow involved, paid off."
"She didn't know what she was saying. She's just lost her husband and unborn child."
"So you're saying the charges are false?"
the man persisted and pushed the microphone closer. Somebody jostled him from behind, and his arm jerked forward and the microphone hit Webb in the mouth, drawing blood. Before he knew it, Webb's fist had shot out and the man was lying on the ground holding his nose. He didn't appear to be all that upset. In fact, he was screaming to his camera unit, "Did you get that? Did you get that?" They all pressed forward more, and Webb, being in the middle of this circle, was pushed around by the sheer weight of the crowd. Cameras were snapping in his face, blinding him. Fat video machines were feeding away. Dozens of voices were jabbering at once. As the knot of people and machines jostled him around, Webb's feet got tangled in a cable, and he went down. The crowd moved in, but he pushed his way back up. This was far past being out of control. Webb felt a bony fist hit him in the back. When he turned, he recognized the attacker as a man who lived down the street and who had never cared much for Webb as a neighbor or a human being. Before Webb could defend himself, the man ran off. As Webb looked around, it was clear that the crowd was not filled just with reporters ravenous for a Pulitzer. This was a mob.
"Get the hell away from me!" Webb screamed.
He yelled at the two agents.
"Are you guys going to help or not?"
"Somebody call the cops," said the perfumed blonde, pointing at Webb. "He just assaulted that poor man. We all saw it."
She bent down to help up her fellow reporter while a slew of cell phones appeared from out of pockets. Webb looked around at a level of chaos he had never before experienced, and he had seen more than most. But he had had enough of this. Webb pulled his pistol. The FBI agents saw this and were suddenly interested once more. Webb pointed the pistol straight up and fired four shots into the air. On all sides of him, the mob now was in full retreat. Some dropped to the ground, crying out, pleading for him not to shoot them, that they were just doing their job, miserable though it might be. The perfumed blonde let her dear reporter friend drop back to the muddy earth and turned and ran for her life. Her heels sank in the soft grass, and she ran right out of them. Her fleshy bottom made a nice target, if Webb had been so inclined. The reporter with the bloody nose was crawling on his belly, shouting, "Are you getting this? Damn it, Seymour, are you getting this?" Neighbors swooped up their kids and fled to their homes. Webb put his pistol away and walked to his Suburban. When the federal agents moved toward him, all he said was, "Don't even think about it." He climbed in the truck and started it up. He rolled down the window. "Thanks for the assist," he told the two men, and then...